This is part two of the Leyland Netcast of the Missional Leadership Conversation with Alan Roxburgh that took place in Toronto on March 19th, 2007. A continuation of questions and answers. We begin with Al responding to a question about the practice of dwelling in the Word.
Dwelling in the Word. Whether we use the language of the transformation of the church, the innovation of church life, missional church, I don't care what language you use. This is not about technique or program, and it's not about great leaders. It is about spiritual discernment. It is about re-engaging at very deep levels the habits and practices of spiritual discernment. Now, when I say that, I also have to say that as evangelicals, we have tended to use the Bible for other than spiritual discernment. We use the Bible in order to take from it what we think are the right doctrines and the right truths to make sure people have got them. We use the Bible in our arguments and fights to show that we are true and right. We use the Bible in order to give people personal, individual, spiritual resources for living. All the time, we tend to come to the Scriptures as those who are in control of those Scriptures, and we are going to use them for certain kinds of ends. To me, the worst illustration of this is, and you've heard me play this one over numbers of times tonight, is when I go into churches or I look at programs where they already have a preordained plan of how you ought to work, and then they're going to introduce all the biblical verses which justify what you're going to be up to. This is using the Bible. And the deep sin of modernity is we turn everything into technique, everything into method, everything into a tool, and we've done that with Scripture. So that, and those of us who've been to seminary and got seminary degrees, we are the worst of these folk. We have been given the tools with which to unpack the Scriptures. And we then are in control and manage the Scriptures and give them to other people. In that way, the Word of God can never read us, can never put us in the place where we are being read. So what we're up to is to say, if there is going to be missional life in the church, whether it's in the institutional churches or new emergent churches, it's not about technique. It's about spiritual discernment. And spiritual discernment is when the text starts to read me and I don't have control over it. How do we get there? So that's the background. And so what we do, Bill spoke of a friend and a dear colleague of mine by the name of Pat Kiefert, who teaches at Luther Seminary. We do something called dwelling in the Word. And this was a gift that was given to Pat by the Sioux Nation in Minnesota. He went in to work with them, and after working with them for a while, they said, "Stop, we want to give you a gift." And he said, "What's that?" "We want to invite you to just dwell with us in the Word, to sit and be still in the presence of the Word." And the particular text that they gave was Luke 10, 1 through 12, the sending of the 70. And for the last 4 or 5 years, every time we get together and every time I go places, we begin by dwelling in the Word, Luke 10, 1 through 12. Here's what happens. When I meet with church folk and denominational organizations, I say, "We're going to start by dwelling in the Word. Here's how we're going to do it." And they love it. And then about 3 months in, there will be a well-coordinated revolt where some pastors will stand up and say, "We have another text. Do we have to stay in this text all the time?" And we go, "You do this very gently." "Yeah, we do. We do. Because you see, We keep thinking we've got all we need out of this text. Now let's move on to another text to get out of it what we need. And it's this whole modernity notion that we get from it what we want rather than letting it speak to us. And so what the Sioux Indian nation gave to us was this process. I'll put it very simply, but behind it there's a whole lot. It's called listening one another into free speech. Let me say that again. Listening one another into free speech. In the belief that we can hear God reading us if we allow the Spirit of God to listen through one another. So instead of having an expert up front lead you in a Bible study or a wonderful thought, that's what we do. We read the passage, Luke 1, 1 through 10, and we invite people just to be still as the passage is read. Don't even open your Bible, just listen. And somewhere in that passage, you're going to stop. This is just one illustration. You're going to keep listening, but you're going to stop somewhere. And what we want you to do is turn to what we call a reasonably friendly stranger. I hate doing this because it's going to sound like a technique. Turn to a reasonably friendly stranger, someone that you don't know, and share with that person where you stopped and what you were hearing and why. And do that with one another. And then we begin to ask, can you feed back what you heard from your reasonably friendly stranger? And it's amazing what starts to happen. It's amazing how you start to hear, not the expert, but what the Spirit's up to amongst people. Every time we meet, we do this. And we begin to train people in how to do it in their board meetings and their other groups. Now let me tell you what happens. Very quickly, someone will stand up and say, what your name is? Yeah, I want to introduce to you, Pennell, my new friend. You see. And you hear that, and you go, yep. You see, one of the things that we want all the time in church life today is intimacy. All right? Intimate experiences. So it doesn't feel good for Pennell to be a reasonably friendly stranger. And what we want to do, and this is what a lot of worship music is about these days, is close the gap so we have an immediate experience of intimacy. And whenever you have an immediate experience of intimacy, Pennell's no longer a stranger or another. We've bonded and blended.
I love you.
I love you. But you see, here's the thing. And this, look, can I just do a little bit of theology for a sec? Built into the very nature of creation is difference. Right? Is difference. Well, let me put it this way. I've been married for almost 40 years, right, to a particularly independent person. And the older I get and the longer we've been together, the more weird she gets. Right? When I want to control her, I get pushback. But when I control her, what I'm doing is I'm trying to close the gap. I'm trying to turn her into me. But here's the thing. To discover, and Jane and I have a lot of fun and a lot of energy and a lot of friction, to discover the creativity and the joy and the beauty of the other is not in closing the gap, it's the difference in between. That's how God made us. Or to put it in a different way, the Father is not the Son and the Son is not the Spirit. They are different. Difference is built into the very nature of creation. So, what's that all about? Here's what it's about. To hear God is to hear God through the other. Social relationality, which our postmodern friends tell us about all the time. And what we're constantly trying to do in churches is close the gap with the other. And what dwelling in the Word invites us to do is actually to listen to the other. And in listening to the other, we hear God. Illustration. In January, I was in Pittsburgh with about 30 congregations that we were training in a whole process. They'd gone away into these listening conversations and dwelling in the Word. I'll tell you a story. Guy, 73 years of age, stands up and he says, these are Presbyterians, so you've got to understand that. He says, I've never done this before. But he said, I've been dwelling in the Word at my church and learning how to listen to the other. He says, here's what happened. I sat with Carl, who's been a member of this church for 15 years. And I said to him, where did you stop in this text? And you know what he said to me? He looked at me. And I think these are Presbyterians. These are middle-class professionals. He said to me, nobody has ever asked me what I think before in this church. And he started to talk. And they started to talk. And they heard God. And they started to be read by the text. And what it begins to do is shift. It shifts this notion that the Bible belongs to the experts. And you can't know the Bible unless you have these experts telling it and translating it. And it says, amongst us, we can hear God. And we do it. Oh, I can tell you stories over and over again of how in ordinary congregations, people are hearing God in this way, in ways that I, as the professional, could never have imagined. So that's what dwelling in the Word is about. But it's not a technique. If you go away and start doing this because it's a new technique, you don't get what I'm trying to describe. It's a way of inviting God's people to discover that God, by the Spirit, is amongst them. And the imagination to hear God is amongst them. And when God's Word is heard and shared amongst them, things happen. So it's not a technique. It's not kind of a new sharing and caring process in a groupy poopy time. It's a whole different piece of engagement. And behind it is this deeper understanding of we've got to let the text read us. And that's about it coming up from amongst the people of God themselves. Does that make sense? Doesn't make sense? Go read Haddon Robinson then.
And this reminds me of an ancient practice of Bible reading. They call the Lectio Divina.
Yes, that's right.
Right?
Lectio Divina.
So interactive.
Ignatian spirituality.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah. That's that Catholic stuff. Some of the biggest church planting movements today are taking place amongst mainline denominations in the United States. Those over which we'd have written Ichabod now are doing all kinds of church planting. And here's the fun part. Many of these denominations are realizing that the culture wars are just a big waste of time. That it's not a matter of black, white, male, female, what kind of worship music do you use, how high you raise your hands, or where you live. The culture wars are just a boring waste of time. They're realizing that. And what's drawing them together, these are main lines that we would have given up on, is the missional conversation and the understanding that without a recovery of a missional imagination, there is no hope. So here I was with United Methodists in Phoenix about 2-3 weeks ago, planting 350 churches a year. Now, here's the fun part. They know, A, they can't train 350 clergy to go plant churches, so that one's out the window. Besides which, you can't afford 350 clergy to plant churches because of the pension plans and everything else, so that one's out of the window. So guess what's starting to get created in the United Methodist Church in the United States? A lay-led movement of church planting, which is completely missional in its imagination. Now think about this one. Right? This is what God is up to in all kinds of places. And so it's no longer about, which is where I used to get upset with some of my friends, it's no longer about, you know, you've got these old established churches, traditional, modernist, you know, we've got to start all this stuff. It's no longer that stuff anymore. It is God is at work in peculiar ways amongst all kinds of people. And you know what it's about? It's about discovering God's future amongst ordinary people in local congregations in a particular place at a particular time. And you don't need big programs from outside to drive this stuff. It's right there amongst people. Now, having said that, here's the problem. Most people who go to seminary don't have a clue how to cultivate lay-led, bottom-up movements of God's imagination. So there's a whole set of skills and learning that a lot of us have got to do. And that's not age-related.
What do you see as the role of denominations now, then, given
sure.
this context?
Yeah. If you want to see Canadian society shaped by the kingdom of God, then you better place your bets on denominations. Let me tell you why. People believe that change always is shaped by the edges. So if you want to really change society, go out to the edge and create new revolutionary movements. It's just not true. There's a movie coming out called Amazing Grace, right? It's the story of who? William Wilberforce. Was William Wilberforce a sectarian? I think he was an Anglican, and he was a member of the gentry. He came from the center of English culture. If you look, you'll see that culture change always comes from the center, affected by the periphery. So, Amazing Grace. 100 years before, John Wesley, in the Anglican Church, seeks a movement of renewal, which is responded to in a reactionary way by the center, out of which comes various forms of Methodism. But in England, if you look at the numbers, Methodists never became a significant group. In other words, they did not penetrate into the culture. What happens is that over a 50 to 80 year period, what they represented moved back into the mainstream of Anglican culture and began to create people like Wilberforce and others, and that's where the real innovation and change came from. So if what you are up to, if what you want is how do we transform Canada, then you better think about denominational systems. Not at the national level, but at the mid-level, these mid-level judicatories. They're not going to go away, and they are the major place for transformation. Why? Because real transformation is about systems. Real change is a systems networked process. And systems and networks, last time I read, are a combination, to simplify it, of bottom-up and top-down. It's not either or. It's not a polarity. It's both end. And the best place where that can happen would be in a city like Toronto, for example, where a denomination at the mid-level begins to imagine how to work with a group of congregations to innovate change. Now, let me just say this and I'll be quiet. What's happening in my experience with denominations are two or three things. One is that they know the old loyalty game, the brand loyalty game, is over and done with. And so a lot of them are shifting to say, well, what we will become is a resource to our churches. And that's a fool's game, because you can't compete with the resources that are out there. The second thing that they're doing is that many leaders in mid-level judicatories are taking language like emergent and missional, and simply borrowing it without understanding it and just rebaptizing all the old tactics. So I'm not pretending that lots of denominational systems are in great health, but I am saying that's where the future lies. What needs to take place is these folk need to learn how do you cultivate the environments of missional life amongst your churches. And where that takes place, mid-level judicatories start to take on a whole different life and energy. So that's a long way of talking about future denominations.
You began with the idea of these conversations that take place among believers, going into the community, engaging the community, and then starting to build that way. A few things you've said is kind of, for me, just kind of gone over here, but I'm more interested in just the last thing you talked about was just the whole idea of the congregational systems. Now, for a local church who's looking to reach into the community, just try to bring it back down to brass tacks.
Yeah.
We're really talking about the local church and the community itself. How do we begin to engage? I know we've in our church we've talked about the community right here.
Yeah.
How do we engage the local school?
Sure.
Or because that's really that's the center of where things begin.
Join the PTA.
Join the PTA. Sure. Just in terms of that as well. You talked earlier about. When you start these conversational groups, you're going to have, in a local church, it just seems to me that if you have a small group going here and a small group going there, are they pulling away from the main congregation? They're going to start their own, then themselves become a local group unto themselves. So they actually look different from the main group that they started with.
Yeah, I mean, I respect the argument. I think it's an argument out of fear. Rather than reality, let me back up a little bit. Your very language of local church, which all of us have in different ways, that's where I would begin and say that's the very thing that we've really got to, in the best sense of the word, deconstruct, because local church usually means standalone congregation, whereas Paul writes to the church in Corinth. Now, but there's a reason for that. It is that the local church, the way we define it, is a mirror image of our individualism. That we stand alone and can do it ourselves. Now, that's not to take away from the fact that this church is called to this community. But my question is this. To pick up the language, in a context of massive cultural change and discontinuity, how do we begin to recover a sense of being the church in this city in which we can learn from and resource one another? So that a local church is part of a network of communities asking and resourcing each other out of these conversations. That's one response. The second response is that actually, when when you begin, well, let me back up. I talk about not creating small groups to do things. But how do you say I'm part of a pastoral staff or another person? I'm looking for where are people wanting to experiment? And I create that in all kinds of ways in conversation. So you invite experiments. But when you invite experiments and you're in those conversations, people don't spin off all over the place. Believe it or not, they don't. They actually invite others to think about different conversations. The spinning off that you're afraid of actually doesn't happen. Why? Because people are finding energy in this working together. So I hear those arguments. I don't think they can be sustained in terms of what actually takes place. In terms of your basic question, how do you engage this community? It's actually not complicated. You do what I do in my neighborhood. I walk across the alleyway and I say to Anne, how you doing? Right? I turn to my neighbor over here and I say, I'm going for a bike ride. Want to come? Because he does. See, engaging neighborhoods to me, I'm not saying you're not saying this, but like, it's like, what's the issue here? It's called human relationships. But here's the point. There was a time not very long ago when if I walked down the street by somebody and didn't understand the ritual politeness of saying, hi, how you doing, I would have been considered to be impolite. Today, if I walk down a street and I say to somebody, hi, they're going to dial 999 or whatever it is on their telephone, because we've created a society that is afraid and frightened of the other, which is why we have neighborhood watch programs, okay, in all these Bible-believing communities. So what we've done is we've created a society in which the other is the stranger who you're afraid of. Which means we are a society which is thin on knowing how to welcome the stranger. And so here's my bet. My guess is that if you really want to know how to transform a community, just learn to cook a good meal and invite somebody to your table and have human conversations that don't have attached to them something you want to sell or have them do. And you will have more social community than you could ever imagine. And out of that would come all kinds of things. So,
if I can just one follow-up. I think that's part of the elephant in the room is that we're afraid of engaging the community. And we're not talking about it in our local congregation, so how do we, we've got, in this church, for example, you know, we look to the pastor to lead.
Right.
And that's true for many of our
all the time,
right?
Yeah.
So I guess that's part of the underlying question.
Yeah. What?
That's part of my underlying thinking, sort of.
Oh, I'm sorry. Yeah. It's actually quite true that in the research we've done, there is a massive passivity in churches that defaults to the leadership. But what I want to say is, we are the culprits. Right? We have created a social community of that kind of passivity. Why? Because, and this is just Newbegin, not only in the fact-value split, but in the public-private split, particularly in evangelicalism, church and religion and spirituality belong to the private world. It's what I do in my private self, okay, not my public world. So when it comes to how do we deal with change and stuff, we default to the public person that we pay, called the pastor. So that's a deep myth that's inside of us, a cultural myth that you got to address.
I'm just trying to get my head around the value of, first of all, a seminary would have, then to equip people to teach.
Right.
How in this whole conversation methodology do people actually get taught the scriptures other than through some of the illustrations you give them?
Certainly, you're asking two or three different questions, but in what I'm describing, I am not describing an either or. So this is not about the inappropriateness of a teaching ministry. It is about how you go about that. So that's one. Secondly, implicit in what you're asking is, what is the role of the seminary? just to say that we've just initiated in the United States a major research project with 24 seminaries across the U.S., actually two in Canada, around the question of what does theological education look like when a missional theology is at its core around the preparation of leaders. And we've had 24 seminaries sign on for that project long term. So this is not a diminishing of the role of the seminary. However, I'll just say this quickly, the very nature of seminaries have to be reconstituted. To a large extent, seminaries as we know them are based upon a certain model of education that came out of Germany in the middle 1800s under Schleiermacher, and it was about the professionalization of leaders for the church in the culture. That model, which still drives seminaries, is broken and destructive in terms of our time. So it needs to be addressed. Having said that, the other thing that's clear is that if you look at the history of the church from, you know, Pentecost on, there are two puduring institutions that are always there. All the rest come and go. Mission societies, denominations, whatever. There's two that are always around. In some form, the school, and in some form, the congregation. So the school is a key to the innovating of missional life. So I am not in any way wanting to undermine or say they're irrelevant. I think those of a younger generation who say seminary education is a waste of time are really living out of a very thin layer of stuff. But those of the younger generation that say seminary trains me for a world that doesn't exist anymore are dead right. So seminaries themselves are caught up in this and are discovering that the missional conversation cuts across the old liberal, conservative, and all that sort of stuff and invites them into a new space to look at how they train people.
Can you talk about imagination? You've been using that word all night.
Could I talk about imagination? I've actually written it and defined it in one of the books I wrote. So, the language has two or three different sides to it. In much of the postmodern conversation, we no longer talk about the truth that everybody has and the one thing that you find, but that we live in a world of multiple narratives. And those narratives in a non-foundationalist world, yeah, I'm getting technical here, it's because I'm getting tired. What I mean by imagination is something like this. When I walk into a congregation, I no longer walk in saying, I got a plan for their life. I walk in and I go, God is amongst these people, and inside them is God's future. That's what I mean by imagination. And so how do I call it forth? Imagination is what is what God builds into creation that is in and among a people who gather to worship. And so when I say missional imagination, what I mean is, to your point, the question, how do we reach this community? My answer is, I haven't a clue. I don't know what it's going to look like, but here's what I am convinced about. Amongst those people that make up that church you're describing, it's all there. That's what I mean by imagination.
We had one person raise their hand just at the last second there before the cutoff. So one more.
Billy Graham's here next week, so you could keep your hand down and be okay.
All right. This is going to sound like a very modernistic question. The goal, if you could answer the question, or if you could finish the statement, a well-lived life is...
No. a well-lived life? I have no idea. I would say I am living today a life that in which I'm living a life in which I feel immensely privileged, that God has given me unbelievable gift and opportunity, and I'm loving it, and I'm in the midst of it, and I'm generative in the midst of it. That's a well-lived life. At the same time, my life is screwed up. I don't get the exercise I want because I'm doing all this stuff. I don't see my wife and kids as much as I want because I'm traveling a lot. I don't know what a well-lived life is. But here's what the goal of it all. The goal of it all is that like this creation of which you and I are priests is going somewhere. It's like, you know, the old Negro spiritual, slow train coming. You know, the slow train coming. And to use Hauerwas's language, this train has been coming for a long time, and we've been invited on to the train. And the train's going to keep going long after we're gone. And the goal is that this creation is a creation that will be alive to its creator in Jesus. That's the goal. And inside of that, you can put all kinds of stuff. What's a well-lived life? A well-lived life is being on the train in all kinds of particular ways. Now, I could go past that and say that, you see, let me just do this and I'll stop. The crappy thing about churches is that they actually tell you that you got to figure out some map of what God's up to. And so we live by, to use Marxist language, all this false consciousness that God has something for us out there that we got to figure out. Whereas I think God says each of us are this incredible gift to creation. And as each of us lives out the uniqueness that we have in relationship with others, we are participating in where creation is going. So what's the well-lived life? The well-lived life is discovering the amazing ways in which God has called me for the sake of the world. But I can only discover that in relationship with a whole bunch of other people and in accountability with a whole bunch of people and as a confessing, worshiping human being. That's the well-lived life. What it all looks like at the end, who knows? Do we all do it? I haven't met anybody that does it. Short of Jesus, of course. Thanks.
I wonder if we could thank Al for coming tonight and for everything.
Good coffee. Thank you.
I hate doing a plug after this, so I'll keep it short. But one of the things Al talked about is just that sense of conversation and dialogue and stuff. And I was at the point a few years ago where just isolated, and I had my own network, but struggling through some of the realities and stuff. And beginning to network with people originally online and then later person to person. And even tonight, I see different networks of people here that, I mean, I think have saved my sanity a lot of times. So if you're not involved with that, it doesn't have to be through Resonate, but I encourage you. I mean, just start that conversation. And if you're interested in Resonate, there's all sorts of ways online, but even better in person to do that. And there's guys like Purnell here and Jared and probably a lot of people who are involved with that. So you could find out more about that.
For more information on Resonate, visit the website resonate.ca. This Alelon Netcast was produced in cooperation with Resonate. Recording engineer and editor, Jared Siebert. Alelon post-production, Bill Kinnan. Please also listen to the Alelon Netcast Roxborough Journal, Episode 3. An interview of Alan by Daryl Dapp. This is part two of the Alelon Netcast of the Missional Leadership Conversation with Alan Roxborough that took place in Toronto on March 19th, 2007. A continuation of questions and answers. We begin with Al responding to a question about the practice of dwelling in the Word.
Dwelling in the Word. whether we use the language of the transformation of the church, the innovation of church life, missional church, I don't care what language you use. This is not about technique or program, and it's not about great leaders. It is about spiritual discernment. It is about re-engaging at very deep levels the habits and practices of spiritual discernment. Now, when I say that, I also have to say that as evangelicals, we have tended to use the Bible for other than spiritual discernment. We use the Bible in order to take from it what we think are the right doctrines and the right truths to make sure people have got them. We use the Bible in our arguments and fights to show that we are true and right. We use the Bible in order to give people personal, individual, spiritual resources for living. All the time, we tend to come to the scriptures as those who are in control of those scriptures, and we are going to use them for certain kinds of ends. To me, the worst illustration of this is, and you've heard me play this one over numbers of times tonight, is when I go into churches or I look at programs where they already have a preordained plan of how you ought to work, and then they're going to introduce all the biblical verses which justify what you're going to be up to. This is using the Bible. And the deep sin of modernity is we turn everything into technique, everything into method, everything into a tool, and we've done that with Scripture. So that, and those of us who've been to seminary and got seminary degrees, we are the worst of these folk. We have been given the tools with which to unpack the Scriptures. And we then are in control and manage the Scriptures and give them to other people. In that way, the Word of God can never read us, can never put us in the place where we are being read. So what we're up to is to say, if there is going to be missional life in the church, whether it's in the institutional churches or new emergent churches, it's not about technique. It's about spiritual discernment. And spiritual discernment is when the text starts to read me and I don't have control over it. How do we get there? So that's the background. And so what we do, Bill spoke of a friend and a dear colleague of mine by the name of Pat Kiefert, who teaches at Luther Seminary. We do something called dwelling in the Word. And this was a gift that was given to Pat by the Sioux Nation in Minnesota. He went in to work with them, and after working with them for a while, they said, "Stop, we want to give you a gift." And he said, "What's that?" "We want to invite you to just dwell with us in the Word, to sit and be still in the presence of the Word." And the particular text that they gave was Luke 10, 1 through 12, the sending of the 70. And for the last 4 or 5 years, every time we get together and every time I go places, we begin by dwelling in the Word, Luke 10, 1 through 12. Here's what happens. When I meet with church folk in denominational organizations, I say, "We're going to start by dwelling in the Word. Here's how we're going to do it." And they love it. And then about 3 months in, there will be a well-coordinated revolt where some pastors will stand up and say, "We have another text. Do we have to stay in this text all the time?" And we go, "You do this very gently." "Yeah, we do. We do. Because you see, we keep thinking we've got all we need out of this text. Now let's move on to another text to get out of it what we need." And it's this whole modernity notion that we get from it what we want rather than letting it speak to us. And so what these Sioux Indian Nation gave to us was this process. I'll put it very simply, but behind it there's a whole lot. It's called listening one another into free speech. Let me say that again. Listening one another into free speech. In the belief that we can hear God reading us if we allow the Spirit of God to listen through one another. So instead of having an expert up front lead you in a Bible study or a wonderful thought, that's what we do. We read the passage, Luke 1, 1 through 10, and we invite people just to be still as the passage is read. Don't even open your Bible, just listen. And somewhere in that passage, you're going to stop. This is just one illustration. You're going to keep listening, but you're going to stop somewhere. And what we want you to do is turn to what we call a reasonably friendly stranger. I hate doing this because it's going to sound like a technique. Turn to a reasonably friendly stranger, someone that you don't know, and share with that person where you stopped and what you were hearing and why. And do that with one another. And then we begin to ask, can you feedback what you heard from your reasonably friendly stranger? And it's amazing what starts to happen. It's amazing how you start to hear, not the expert, but what the Spirit's up to amongst people. Every time we meet, we do this. And we begin to train people in how to do it in their board meetings and their other groups. Now, let me tell you what happens. Very quickly, someone will stand up and say, what your name is?
Pernell.
Yeah. I want to introduce to you, Pernell, my new friend. You see. And you hear that, and you go, yep. You see, one of the things that we want all the time in church life today is intimacy. All right? Intimate experiences. So it doesn't feel good for Pernell to be a reasonably friendly stranger. And what we want to do, and this is what a lot of worship music is about these days, is close the gap so we have an immediate experience of intimacy. And whenever you have an immediate experience of intimacy, Pernell's no longer a stranger or another. We've bonded and blended.
I love you.
I love you. But you see, here's the thing. And this, look, can I just do a little bit of theology for a sec? Built into the very nature of creation is difference. Right? Is difference. Well, let me put it this way. I've been married for almost 40 years, right, to a particularly independent person. And the older I get and the longer we've been together, the more weird she gets. Right? When I want to control her, I get pushback. But when I control her, what I'm doing is I'm trying to close the gap. I'm trying to turn her into me. But here's the thing. To discover, and Jane and I have a lot of fun and a lot of energy and a lot of friction, to discover the creativity and the joy and the beauty of the other is not in closing the gap, it's the difference in between. That's how God made us. Or to put it in a different way, the Father is not the Son, and the Son is not the Spirit. They are different. Difference is built into the very nature of creation. So, what's that all about? Here's what it's about. To hear God is to hear God through the other. Social relationality, which our postmodern friends tell us about all the time. And what we're constantly trying to do in churches is close the gap with the other. And what dwelling in the Word invites us to do is actually to listen to the other. And in listening to the other, we hear God. Illustration. In January, I was in Pittsburgh with about 30 congregations that we were training in a whole process. They'd gone away into these listening conversations and dwelling in the Word. I'll tell you a story. Guy, 73 years of age, stands up and he says, these are Presbyterians, so you've got to understand that. He says, I've never done this before. But he said, I've been dwelling in the Word at my church and learning how to listen to the other. He says, here's what happened. I sat with Carl, who's been a member of this church for 15 years. And I said to him, where did you stop in this text? And you know what he said to me? He looked at me. And I think these are Presbyterians. These are middle-class professionals. He said to me, nobody has ever asked me what I think before in this church. And he started to talk. And they started to talk. And they heard God. And they started to be read by the text. And what it begins to do is shift. It shifts this notion that the Bible belongs to the experts. And you can't know the Bible unless you have these experts telling it and translating it. And it says, amongst us, we can hear God. And we do it. Oh, I can tell you stories over and over again of how in ordinary congregations, people are hearing God in this way, in ways that I, as the professional, could never have imagined. So that's what dwelling in the Word is about. But it's not a technique. If you go away and start doing this because it's a new technique, you don't get what I'm trying to describe. It's a way of inviting God's people to discover that God by the Spirit is amongst them. And the imagination to hear God is amongst them. And when God's Word is heard and shared amongst them, things happen. So it's not a technique. It's not kind of a new sharing and caring process in a groupy poopy time. It's a whole different piece of engagement. And behind it is this deeper understanding of we've got to let the text read us. And that's about it coming up from amongst the people of God themselves. Does that make sense? Doesn't make sense? Go read Haddon Robinson then.
And this reminds me of an ancient practice of Bible reading. They call the Lectio Divina.
Yes, that's right.
Right?
Lectio Divina.
It's so interactive.
Ignatian spirituality.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah. That's that Catholic stuff. Some of the biggest church planting movements today are taking place amongst mainline denominations in the United States. Those over which we'd have written Ichabod now are doing all kinds of church planting. And here's the fun part. Many of these denominations are realizing that the culture wars are just a big waste of time. That it's not a matter of black, white, male, female, what kind of worship music do you use, how high you raise your hands, or where you live. The culture wars are just a boring waste of time. They're realizing that. And what's drawing them together, these are main lines that we would have given up on, is the missional conversation and the understanding that without a recovery of a missional imagination, there is no hope. So here I was with United Methodists in Phoenix about 2-3 weeks ago, planting 350 churches a year. Now, here's the fun part. They know, A, they can't train 350 clergy to go plant churches, so that one's out the window. Besides which, you can't afford 350 clergy to plant churches because of the pension plans and everything else. So that one's out of the window. So guess what's starting to get created in the United Methodist Church in the United States? A lay-led movement of church planting, which is completely missional in its imagination. Now think about this one, all right? This is what God is up to in all kinds of places. And so it's no longer about, which is where I used to get upset with some of my friends, it's no longer about, you've got these old established churches, traditional, modernist, You know, we've got to start all this stuff. It's no longer that stuff anymore. It is God is at work in peculiar ways amongst all kinds of people. And you know what it's about? It's about discovering God's future amongst ordinary people in local congregations in a particular place at a particular time. And you don't need big programs from outside to drive this stuff. It's right there amongst people. Now, having said that, here's the problem. Most people who go to seminary don't have a clue how to cultivate lay-led, bottom-up movements of God's imagination. So there's a whole set of skills and learning that a lot of us have got to do. And that's not age-related.
What do you see as the role of denominations now, then, given
sure.
this context?
Yeah. If you want to see Canadian society shaped by the kingdom of God, then you better place your bets on denominations. Let me tell you why. People believe that change always is shaped by the edges. So if you want to really change society, go out to the edge and create new revolutionary movements. It's just not true. There's a movie coming out called Amazing Grace, right? It's the story of who? William Wilberforce. Was William Wilberforce a sectarian? He was an Anglican, and he was a member of the gentry. He came from the center of English culture. If you look, you'll see that culture change always comes from the center, affected by the periphery. So, Amazing Grace. 100 years before, John Wesley, in the Anglican Church, seeks a movement of renewal, which is responded to in a reactionary way by the center, out of which comes various forms of Methodism. But in England, if you look at the numbers, Methodists never became a significant group. In other words, they did not penetrate into the culture. What happens is that over a 50 to 80 year period, what they represented moved back into the mainstream of Anglican culture and began to create people like Wilberforce and others, and that's where the real innovation and change came from. So if what you are up to, if what you want is how do we transform Canada, then you better think about denominational systems. Not at the national level, but at the mid-level, these mid-level judicatories. They're not going to go away, and they are the major place for transformation. Why? Because real transformation is about systems. Real change is a systems networked process. And systems and networks, last time I read, are a combination, to simplify it, of bottom-up and top-down. It's not either or. It's not a polarity. It's both end. And the best place where that can happen would be in a city like Toronto, for example, where a denomination at the mid-level begins to imagine how to work with a group of congregations to innovate change. Now, let me just say this and I'll be quiet. What's happening in my experience with denominations are two or three things. One is that they know the old loyalty game, the brand loyalty game, is over and done with. And so a lot of them are shifting to say, well, what we will become is a resource to our churches. And that's a fool's game, because you can't compete with the resources that are out there. The second thing that they're doing is that many leaders in mid-level judicatories are taking language like emergent and missional and simply borrowing it without understanding it and just rebaptizing all the old tactics. So I'm not pretending that lots of denominational systems are in great health, but I am saying that's where the future lies. What needs to take place is these folk need to learn how do you cultivate the environments of missional life amongst your churches. And where that takes place, mid-level judicatories start to take on a whole different life and energy. So that's a long way of talking about future denominations.
You began with the idea of these conversations that take place among believers, going into the community, engaging the community, and then starting to build that way. A few things you've said is kind of, for me, just kind of gone over here, but I'm more interested in just the last thing you talked about was just the whole idea of the congregational systems. Now, for a local church who's looking to reach into the community, I mean, just try to bring it back down to brass tacks.
Yeah.
We're really talking about the local church and the community itself. How do we begin to engage? I know we've in our church, we've talked about the community right here.
Yeah.
How do we engage the local school?
Sure.
Or because that's really that's the center of where things begin.
Join the PTA.
Join the PTA, sure. Just in terms of that as well, you talked earlier about when you start these conversational groups, you're going to have in a local church. It just seems to me that if you have a small group going here and a small group going there, are they pulling away from the main congregation? They're going to start their own. They in themselves become a local group unto themselves. So they actually look different from the main group that they started with.
Yeah, I mean, I respect the argument. I think it's an argument out of fear rather than reality. But let me back up a little bit. Your very language of local church, which all of us have in different ways, that's where I would begin and say that's the very thing that we've really got to, in the best sense of the word, deconstruct. Because local church usually means standalone congregation. Whereas, Paul writes to the church in Corinth. Now, but there's a reason for that. It is that the local church, the way we define it, is a mirror image of our individualism. That we stand alone and can do it ourselves. Now, that's not to take away from the fact that this church is called to this community. But my question is this. To pick up the language, in a context of massive cultural change and discontinuity, how do we begin to recover a sense of being the church in this city in which we can learn from and resource one another? So that a local church is part of a network of communities asking and resourcing each other out of these conversations. That's one response. The second response is that actually, when when you begin, well, let me back up. I talk about not creating small groups to do things. But how do you say I'm part of pastoral staff or another person? I'm looking for where are people wanting to experiment? And I create that in all kinds of ways in conversation. So you invite experiments, but when you invite experiments and you're in those conversations, people don't spin off all over the place. Believe it or not, they don't. They actually invite others to think about different conversations. The spinning off that you're afraid of actually doesn't happen. Why? Because people are finding energy in this working together. I hear those arguments. I don't think they can be sustained in terms of what actually takes place. In terms of your basic question, how do you engage this community? It's actually not complicated. You do what I do in my neighborhood. I walk across the alleyway and I say to Ann, how you doing? Right? I turn to my neighbor over here and I say, I'm going for a bike ride. Want to come? Because he does. See, engaging neighborhoods to me, I'm not saying you're not saying this, but like, it's like, what's the issue here? It's called human relationships. But here's the point. There was a time not very long ago when if I walked down the street by somebody and didn't understand the ritual politeness of saying, hi, how you doing? I would have been considered to be impolite. Today, if I walk down a street and I say to somebody, hi, they're going to dial 999 or whatever it is on their telephone, because we've created a society that is afraid and frightened of the other, which is why we have neighborhood watch programs, okay, in all these Bible-believing communities. So what we've done is we've created a society in which the other is the stranger who you're afraid of, which means we are a society which is thin on knowing how to welcome the stranger. And so here's my bet. My guess is that if you really want to know how to transform a community, just learn to cook a good meal and invite somebody to your table and have human conversations that don't have attached to them something you want to sell or have them do. And you will have more social community than you could ever imagine. And out of that would come all kinds of things. So,
if I can just one follow up, I think that's part of the elephant in the room is that we're afraid of engaging the community. And we're not talking about it in our local congregation. So how do we, we've got in this church, for example, you know, we look to the pastor to lead.
Right. It's
And that's true for many of our
all the time,
right?
Yeah.
So I guess that's part of the underlying question.
Yeah. What?
That's part of my underlying thinking. Sorry.
Oh, I'm sorry. Yeah. It's actually quite true that in the research we've done, there is a massive passivity in churches that defaults to the leadership. But what I want to say is, we are the culprits. Right. We have created a social community of that kind of passivity. Why? Because, and this is just Newbegin, not only in the fact-value split, but in the public-private split, particularly in evangelicalism, church and religion and spirituality belong to the private world. It's what I do in my private self, okay, not my public world. So when it comes to how do we deal with change and stuff, we default to the public person that we pay, called the pastor. So that's a deep myth that's inside of us, a cultural myth that you got to address.
I'm just trying to get my head around the value of, first of all, a seminary would have, then to equip people to teach.
Right.
How in this whole conversation methodology do people actually get taught the scriptures other than through some of the illustrations you give them?
Certainly, you're asking two or three different questions, but in what I'm describing, I am not describing an either or. So this is not about the inappropriateness of a teaching ministry. It is about how you go about that. So that's one. Secondly, implicit in what you're asking is, what is the role of the seminary? Just to say that we've just initiated in the United States a major research project with 24 seminaries across the U.S., actually two in Canada, around the question of what does theological education look like when a missional theology is at its core around the preparation of leaders. And we've had 24 seminaries sign on for that project long term. So this is not a diminishing of the role of the seminary. However, I'll just say this quickly. The very nature of seminaries have to be reconstituted. To a large extent, seminaries as we know them are based upon a certain model of education that came out of Germany in the middle 1800s under Schleiermacher, and it was about the professionalization of leaders for the church in the culture. That model, which still drives seminaries, is broken and destructive in terms of our time. So it needs to be addressed. Having said that, the other thing that's clear is that if you look at the history of the church from, you know, Pentecost on, there are two perduring institutions that are always there. All the rest come and go. Mission societies, denominations, whatever. There's two that are always around. In some form, the school, and in some form, the congregation. So the school is a key to the innovating of missional life. So I am not in any way wanting to undermine or say they're irrelevant. I think those of a younger generation who say seminary education is a waste of time are really living out of a very thin layer of stuff. But those of the younger generation that say seminary trains me for a world that doesn't exist anymore are dead right. So seminaries themselves are caught up in this and are discovering that the missional conversation cuts across the old liberal, conservative, and all that sort of stuff and invites them into a new space to look at how they train people.
Can you talk about imagination? You've been using that word all night.
Could I talk about imagination? I've actually written it and defined it in one of the books I wrote. So, the language is has two or three different sides to it. In much of the postmodern conversation, we no longer talk about the truth that everybody has and the one thing that you find, but that we live in a world of multiple narratives. And those narratives in a non-foundationalist world, I'm getting technical here, it's because I'm getting tired. What I mean by imagination is something like this. When I walk into a congregation, I no longer walk in saying, I got a plan for their life. I walk in and I go, God is amongst these people, and inside them is God's future. That's what I mean by imagination. And so how do I call it forth? Imagination is what God builds into creation that is in and among a people who gather to worship. And so when I say missional imagination, what I mean is, to your point, the question, how do we reach this community? My answer is, I haven't a clue. I don't know what it's going to look like. But here's what I am convinced about. Amongst those people that make up that church you're describing, it's all there. That's what I mean by imagination.
We had one person raise their hand just at the last second there before the cutoff. So one more.
Billy Graham's here next week, so you could keep your hand down and be okay.
All right. This is going to sound like a very modernistic question. The goal, if you could answer the question, or if you could finish a statement, a well-lived life is... ..
No. a well-lived life? I have no idea. I would say I am living today a life that in which I I'm living a life in which I feel immensely privileged, that God has given me unbelievable gift and opportunity, and I'm loving it, and I'm in the midst of it, and I'm generative in the midst of it. That's a well-lived life. At the same time, my life is screwed up. I don't get the exercise I want because I'm doing all this stuff. I don't see my wife and kids as much as I want because I'm traveling a lot. I don't know what a well-lived life is. But here's what the goal of it all. The goal of it all is that like this creation of which you and I are priests is going somewhere. It's like, you know, the old Negro spiritual, slow train coming. You know, the slow train coming. And to use Hauerwas's language, this train has been coming for a long time, and we've been invited on to the train. And the train's going to keep going long after we're gone. And the goal is that this creation is a creation that will be alive to its creator in Jesus. That's the goal. And inside of that, you can put all kinds of stuff. What's a well-lived life? A well-lived life is being on the train in all kinds of particular ways. Now, I could go past that and say that, you see, let me just do this and I'll stop. The crappy thing about churches is that they actually tell you that you got to figure out some map of what God's up to. And so we live by, to use Marxist language, all this false consciousness that God has something for us out there that we got to figure out. Whereas I think God says each of us are this incredible gift to creation. And as each of us lives out the uniqueness that we have in relationship with others, we are participating in where creation is going. So what's the well-lived life? The well-lived life is discovering the amazing ways in which God has called me for the sake of the world. But I can only discover that in relationship with a whole bunch of other people and in accountability with a whole bunch of people and as a confessing, worshiping human being. That's the well-lived life. What it all looks like at the end, who knows? Do we all do it? I haven't met anybody that does it, short of Jesus, of course. Thanks.
I wonder if we could thank Al for coming tonight and for everything.
Good coffee. Thank you.
I hate doing a plug after this, so I'll keep it short. But one of the things Al talked about is just that sense of conversation and dialogue and stuff. And I was at the point a few years ago where just isolated, and I had my own network, but struggling through some of the realities and stuff. And beginning to network with people originally online and then later person to person. And even tonight, I see different networks of people here that, I mean, I think have saved my sanity a lot of times. So if you're not involved with that, it doesn't have to be through Resonate, but I encourage you. I mean, just start that conversation. And if you're interested in Resonate, there's all sorts of ways online, but even better in person to do that. And there's guys like Purnell here and Jared and probably a lot of people who are involved with that. So you could find out more about that.
For more information on Resonate, visit the website resonate.ca. This Leyland Netcast was produced in cooperation with Resonate. Recording engineer and editor, Jared Siebert. Leyland post-production, Bill Kinnan. Please also listen to the Leyland Netcast Roxborough Journal, Episode 3, an interview of Alan by Daryl Dash, recorded earlier that same day. Thank you for listening to this Leyland Netcast.